The Amherst Affair. Austin, Mabel, and Emily, too.
What happened was Austin and Mabel used Emily's house. They used her dining room, to be precise. And that's where their trysts took place. And Emily was fully aware of that. And that was what first fascinated me about this story. Not so much 19th century adultery, which is a great deal more common than many people realize, but the fact that Emily Dickinson, a poet who I've adored for 40 years, knew about it, endorsed it, colluded in it. And I think this causes me, at least, to read her poetry afresh. So I was fascinated by the story, the light it shed on passion, on sex, on delusions of love as well, and on Emily herself.
That's William Nicholson. We talk with him about his new novel, Amherst. It's about the passionate affair between Emily Dickinson's brother Austin and Mabel Todd. And later, we re-air part of my 2007 interview with Debbie Applegate about her biography of another 19th century figure associated, at least for a time, with Amherst, Massachusetts. That's fiery evangelical preacher Henry Ward Beecher. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. Amherst, Massachusetts in the late 19th century was a lot sexier place than any of us might have imagined. It was the setting for one of the most famous illicit affairs in American history. In 1882, Mabel Todd, the beautiful young wife of Amherst College physics professor David Todd, began a passionate long-term liaison with then 53-year-old Austin Dickinson, Emily Dickinson's brother. Austin and Mabel left behind a detailed record of their affair in diaries, which have provided British writer William Nicholson with ample material for his new novel, Amherst. But Nicholson also invents another contemporary affair running in parallel to that of the two 19th century lovers. It's between a young woman who's come to Amherst to write a screenplay about Austin and Mabel and a handsome older professor of English at Amherst College. The novel uses the two affairs to explore the nature of love and attraction and the role they play in the pursuit of the self. Throughout the novel, the figure of Emily Dickinson hovers like a muse. She and Mabel Todd never met in person, but they nonetheless had a mysterious bond. Emily approved of and may have abetted the affair between her brother and Mabel. And after Emily's death, Mabel Todd worked tirelessly to bring the poet's work to the world. It's in large part due to her efforts that we know and celebrate Emily Dickinson today. William Nicholson is a prolific novelist as well as an Oscar-nominated screenwriter. He wrote the screenplays for Shadowlands and Mandela, Long Walk to Freedom, among other films. I started out our conversation by asking Nicholson to tell us about Austin and Mabel's liaison.
Well, it all began, Emily Dickinson, as I'm sure all your listeners know, by this stage was living a reclusive life. She had shut herself away in the building called the Homestead. And not far away, next door, 50 paces away, was another house called the Evergreens, where her beloved brother, Austin, lived with his wife, Sue, and children. And he would see Emily, and Emily's sister, Vinnie, would see Emily, who lived with Emily in the homestead, but nobody else saw her. They barely knew that she wrote poems. Some people knew it. So Austin was not happy in his marriage. Sue, as far as we understand it, was very afraid of childbirth, which, you know, gives you understandably a fear of sex. So reading between the lines, it looks like they didn't have much of a sex life. Into this world of Amherst, where Austin was a very grand old man. I mean, he was in his mid-50s, a lawyer, the treasurer of the college, highly respectable guy, and of course married. Into this world came Mabel Loomis Todd, who was 24 years old at the time, married to David Todd, who came to do a job as an astronomer at the college. And Mabel was very pretty, knew that men were prone to falling in love with her, very eager for attention, not entirely satisfied with her life with David. I mean, she got on very well with David, actually, and rather astonishingly, they had a very good sex life. David was very sexually advanced, really, for his times. But Mabel wanted more, and, you know, to cut to the chase, she met Austin, and she found something in him that she needed, possibly a father substitute initially. He found something in her that completely blew him away. And gradually, it didn't happen quickly. Over a period of a year or so, their contacts, initially Mabel was well-received by Sue, blossomed into romance, which was, of course, breaking every rule. The love which they began confessing to each other slowly turned into a physical affair. Now, you have a question here. If you're, if this is in the 1870s, 1880s in Amherst, in New England, there isn't a Holiday Inn you can pop down to have your affair in. So where do you actually do the deed? And what happened was Austin and Mabel used Emily's house. They used her dining room, to be precise. And that's where their trysts took place. And Emily was fully aware of that. And that was what first fascinated me about this story. Not so much 19th century adultery, which is a great deal more common than many people realize, but the fact that Emily Dickinson, a poet who I've adored for 40 years, knew about it, endorsed it, colluded in it. And I think this causes me, at least, to read her poetry afresh. So I was fascinated by this story, the light it shed on passion, on sex, on delusions of love as well, and on Emily herself.
Now, William Nicholson, Mabel Todd was an absolutely fascinating person in her own right. Tell us more about her and the fascination you have for her as well, because I think you painted her beautifully in this novel, Amherst.
Well, she does fascinate me. Her father, who she adored, was, I think, a disappointed man. He worked as a nautical clerk, kind of compiling almanacs, which did not satisfy him. This was a man who had in his day known Emerson and Thoreau, and he definitely saw himself as a thinker, a writer, and this was the kind of world that he admired. And Mabel sensed his disappointment that he hadn't become everything that he wanted in life. Now, my reading, and, you know, we're into the realms of speculation here, but my reading is that Mabel herself said to herself, I'm not going to let that happen to me. I'm not going to be somebody who gets to the end of my life and says that that wasn't the fullest, most intense life that I could have lived. So she was hungry for intense experience. Now, if you add this to the fact that as a young woman at that time, not many roads were open to her. Obviously, marriage. She had got married. In some senses, that had given her what she wanted. But the man she married, David Todd, was quite open with her about the fact that he had had affairs with other women, that he found other women attractive, and that he probably would in the future have affairs with other women. Mabel managed to absorb this and was not too thrown by it, but it did make her realize that David would never be the one who was going to give her the kind of intense sense of exclusive adoration that I think she was craving. You know, I mean, I'll quote you something that she wrote that I went and read her diaries in Yale in the Sterling Memorial Library. And if I just read you this, this is 6th of February, 1890. Mabel wrote, I had a passionate longing to be loved for my own individual aroma, not because I was a bright and pretty woman, of whom there are many similar equally attractive. If I should die, David would soon marry again. But I am the one woman for all time to Austin. I, just myself, and because it is I. Now, I find that really interesting. That's using love, using sexual attraction as the pursuit of selfhood, of more complete selfhood. And I think that's what was going on with Mabel, which is why when she realized that Emily, this mysterious person who she never met, she went into the house, she played music, she sang with Vinnie, the sister present, And Emily was listening at the door, but she never met her. Emily sent in on a little tray, as was her habit, a glass of sherry and a poem. Mabel encountered Emily's poems, and Mabel was the first, really, I believe, to understand Emily's greatness. To Mabel, this was extraordinary. This was somebody writing things she'd never encountered ever in her life. And the most significant thing about Mabel, if you care about Emily Dickinson, is that it was Mabel, the mistress of her brother, of Emily's brother, who brought Emily's poems to the public. Because when Emily died, they found these 1,800 poems in a drawer in her room. Of course, they knew she'd been writing poems, but nobody knew the extent of it. Nobody wanted them. Austin didn't think they were any good. His wife, Sue, didn't think they were any good. The literati who Emily had corresponded with were pretty dubious about it all. They seemed to her to be a mess. It was Mabel who took those poems and browbeat first Thomas Wentworth Higginson into assisting her in editing an edition, and then when Higginson's word failed at his own publisher, to Higginson's humiliation, and he said, "I don't want to have anything more to do with this," she went on and she browbeat the next publisher along the line, and she did it by reading them aloud, because the poems look strange on the page, or they did then. She read them aloud, and that was when they came to life. So actually, this strange, spoilt, vain, in some senses adolescent woman was the woman who has given us Emily Dickinson. I find that absolutely fascinating.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with novelist and screenwriter William Nicholson about his new novel, Amherst. It's about the affair between Emily Dickinson's brother, Austin, and Mabel. It's about the affair between Emily Dickinson's brother, Austin, and Mabel Todd. And you mentioned that for her, love was a form of self-expression, sexuality. I mean, I think it's very telling that she uses the word aroma, a really, erotic word in itself, certainly in this context, that love expresses individual personality, drive, and Emily Dickinson's poems also, I think, were really a leap forward in a sense into modernity, into this modern idea that we have as individuals, that our individual passions are so important. What is your take on that?
I entirely agree. I mean, the astonishing thing about Emily Dickinson is how modern she is. She seems, by her withdrawal from the world, she seems to have been able to escape the limiting horizons of New England of her day. I think probably that was her deliberate intention. I sense in Emily Dickinson an enormous pride, a highly intelligent woman saying, "I will not play the game by your rules. By your rules, I must be married and I must be subservient to a man. And that's not how I feel, and it's not what I'm going to do. And if that means I'm on my own, then I'm on my own. And let's see where I get from there." And where she gets to, the explorations are in her poems. So I think she was astonishingly open. The fact that she countenanced this sexual affair, I think, tells us a lot about that. And remember, I mean, this affair, which the sexuality of it is brought to us very clearly by the diaries. Both Mabel and Austin kept diaries. And in these diaries, they noted the times they had sex. They had a little code that they put in. Mabel was having sex with Austin and with her husband David on alternating nights for periods of time. She limited her lovemaking to the time when she was fairly sure she was not likely to conceive. So they, it was only half the month, really, that she had available. And she jolly well packed it in that time. And the further astonishing fact we discover is that David, who, as I've explained, was very open sexually, he knew all about it. There's no secret to him. He liked Austin very much. They became good friends. And there came a point when he said to Mabel, "Can I watch? Can I come and watch?" And he did. And you see it in their diary. Austin puts his little mark, meaning sex, and in brackets, "with a witness." And that was David. Now, I don't make a great deal of that in the novel because I don't know enough about it. I refer to it. But how extraordinary is that? And of course, they had a further witness who wasn't actually in the same room as them, who was Emily, who must have known. She knew who came into the house and who didn't. And it just overthrows every idea you might have about how we invented sex in 1963 or whatever. Passion, expression of self through sex, discovery of meaning in life through sex, love through sex. It's been going on forever, and it was certainly going on in Puritan New England in the 1880s.
Yes, not so Puritan New England. This is also, though, a theme that is echoed in the other story, a story taking place in contemporary times, an affair, one could say, but really not on the same level of passion. Tell us about that. You have this character, Alice Dickinson, no relation, but still the same last name, who has come from England, who's kind of a stand-in for you, perhaps, in some ways. She wants to write a screenplay. Tell us about her and the affair that she has with Nick.
Well, I wanted to write about the world of Emily Dickinson. I wanted to find a way into it. I didn't want to write, as it were, just a historical novel. I wanted to be able to reflect both myself as author and my readers to get some distance on what the 19th century affair reveals and to use it to reflect upon passionate love, love that is almost uncontrollable, which is the feeling we get when we read the diaries of and the letters of Austin and Mabel, that they were possessed by something that they could not control, which, by the way, in order to justify it to themselves, they concluded came from God. Only God could give them such strong feelings, therefore it was okay to break the rules. Now, that interested me a lot because from where I'm coming, there's a delusional aspect to that. It obviously suits them to say this and to be able to do what they so passionately want. But then there's the further question is, what is this passionate desire? And every novel I've ever written has had some element of exploration of intense love, whether it's of short duration or of long duration. So I decided I wanted to parallel the 19th century love affair with a sort of almost comedic alternative version today. So I created a plot whereby my 24-year-old, same age as Mabel, my 24-year-old British girl goes to Amherst to research. She works in advertising, but she wants to be a screenwriter. So she goes to research this story that she's encountered of Mabel and Austin. She's going to turn it into a screenplay. While she's there, she has to have somewhere to stay, and she stays via a series of contacts in a very fine house in Amherst, which, by the way, is a real house. It's currently occupied by the Amherst Woman's Club, and it's very close to the homestead. And in my version, it's owned by a very wealthy American woman who has married an English academic who is the contact. So she shows up, my heroine, at the house of this English academic and gradually realizes he's a bit washed up. His contract has been, his course has been canceled. He's been teaching at the college. But he's extremely attractive and has a terrific reputation in the town as a seducer. So he's obviously had sex with a lot of his students. So the first thing she says is, well, you know, no way am I interested in that. She finds it offensive that this 54-year-old man is playing around with sophomores. However, we begin to realize that something is happening to her with this guy who is very well informed about Emily Dickinson and about the Austin Mabel affair. She likes talking to him about it. And the more because she needs to think through, what story am I telling? What am I to conclude about this extraordinary passion? Was it real? Is this what passion is? Were they kidding themselves? Was it just that Austin had the hots for her and translated it all into this elevated language? And so she's working this through in her mind, talking to Nick, this English academic. Now, this is, of course, very, very much of a turn-on. And she begins to realize that she's kind of getting to a point where she actually is attracted to this guy. But he's married, and he's older than her, and it's ridiculous. And how can you do that? It gradually emerges that, in fact, the marriage has been failed for several months that they're going to get a divorce, that his wife, who's a very sensible, mature woman, is completely okay about it all. He is therefore available. So what we watch is a sort of parallel fascination between an older man and a young woman, parallel to the 19th century one, which both echoes it and reflects on it. And as she gets to know Nick, they lie in bed together, reading Emily Dickinson's poetry and arguing about how much Emily knew about sex. And they're discussing what Mabel and Austin did, even as in the book, we're dropping back in the next chapter to the actual events, and we're witnessing events which my contemporary characters were unable to witness, but which echo what they're talking about. So as her affair develops, which is not at all on the same scale as Mabel's affair, but it does share a quality of a compulsion. She sort of begins to realize she's going to do it, even though she thinks it's a bad idea. And this means that I'm able, through the novel, and this was my intention, to use these two layers to throw up a question for all of us. What do we mean when we talk about falling in love? What do we mean when we talk about very powerful desire? How much is it psychological? How much are we pursuing our longings for our father? Or how much is it all about attention seeking? How much is it the joy of finding somebody who you actually share some mental space with? And to do that with the physical sharing as well is very exciting. How much are we fooling ourselves? What is real? And if you're going to tell a story about all of this, because a book is a story, a novel is a story, what's the story? And I use her, Alice, the contemporary woman's puzzling about how can she tell a story about Austin and Mabel to ask the greater question, what is a love story anyway? And what the book gradually leads you towards understanding is that a love story is only one chapter in a life. It's not a life. That actually, it's the life story that you need to look at, that you're exploring. And of course, Mabel lived for, I can't remember now, 35 years after Austin died. So you can't describe her life as being about that love affair, as leading to that love affair and culminating in that love affair. It went on. She became a lecturer. She became successful in many ways. She lived to be a very old lady, dying in Florida. So this obsession we have with just seeing people through their love affair is, I suppose, something that I'm trying to unpack and question via these two layers of love affairs. Because, of course, Alice has to leave. She's going back to England. And in the course of this very short time she's there, she's only there 2 weeks, she learns stuff about Nick through the intensity of their relationship that she never would have known otherwise. And we discover that Nick is not what we think in all sorts of ways. And so I think, you know, Alice too grows up. The notion that you can just have an excited little fling, it kind of doesn't quite work out because there's so much more going on in both of you that is brought to the surface by a sexual affair. That, as I say, causes you to realize this is more about your pursuit of your own identity. I think that's, I suppose, what the novel is concluding, than about lust or a desire for companionship.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with William Nicholson about his new novel, Amherst.
So what you're really saying here is, as I think one of the characters says at one point in the book, is that this is not really a love story, it's a life story.
That's right. I use the book to question the concept of the love story and to say, why do we tell so many stories that are love stories when actually the bit that is the love story is a quite small piece of somebody's life? Now, people may disagree with me, and they may say, oh, no, the way life works is you're young, you grow to maturity, you fall in love, and that love becomes your lifelong glory and companionship and everything, and it produces children, and that's what matters. So the classic tale, which ends, reader, I married him, makes sense. Now, I'm challenging that. I'm saying, no, it doesn't. That's not how life is. the bit in which you fall in love and become passionate about somebody is fantastic and great to have stories about it, but it's quite brief. I mean, in the case of Mabel and Austin, it was 13 years, which is not so brief, but, you know, in a life of 80 years, it's only one bit. And I want to say we should view our lives. I think we live our lives in chapters. Obviously, there are chapters in childhood as you evolve, and then when you're young. And at each stage, something is significant. The bit when you're young and falling in love and choosing a mate is one chapter. The bit when you have children and when the children are young and dominating your life, that's another chapter. And the chapters carry on. I mean, I'm 67 now, and let me tell you, it is not ending. The constant experience of reinventing oneself and one's life, it goes on until your brain drops off. And so I want to say that don't talk about love story, talk about life story, of which love is just one part.
Oh, that's quite wonderful. And William Nicholson, in this novel, Amherst, I want to ask you a little bit about the writing of it as well. The novel is somewhat about a screenwriter writing a screenplay. You're a screenwriter writing a novel. I wonder if you could weigh in a little bit about the difference between these two types of writing and how they may have, how screenwriting itself may have informed the writing of this book.
Well, I've done a great deal of screenwriting. However, I do want to make it clear that way back, it was novel writing that was my thing. I mean, when I was a young man, I wrote a lot of novels. None of them were published. And when, through a series of accidents, I stumbled into screenwriting, I then made that be my main endeavor because people were actually wanting it. And there's a limit to how much you can write stuff that nobody wants. So I did then have the sort of whole middle part of my career was television and movies. Then I felt I'd kind of grown up enough and learned enough to turn back to my first love, which is book writing, novels. I began by writing children's novels and then moved into adult novels. And ever since then, I've combined screenwriting and novel writing. But in my heart of hearts, I would rather be a novelist than a screenwriter. And that's because, and by the way, I it's not that I dislike the screenwriting or feel in some way that I want to knock it. I love it. The people who I work with are terrific. It's taught me an enormous amount. But when you do screenwriting, you do not control your own work. That's problem number one. And problem number two, you can't do with screen work what the novel can do and what I love about the novel, which is to go into the hearts and minds of characters. You just can't do it. And I mean, you could have endless voiceover, but that doesn't really work. You have to do something different in film. You have to use the events you create and the power of the actors to give an understanding of what's going on inside them. But you can't do that thing that I love so much, which is share with my readers my understanding of what is really happening inside people, because I do think we all mistake each other. So I love novels better. I continue to do screenplays, and the two, I think, feed each other in my life. They feed each other because the screenplays, I work faster, I work collaboratively. In other words, I produce my work and other people critique it and tell me to change it and tell me what's wrong with it, and that's very healthy. Also, they demand of me in my screenplays that I entertain. They're not interested in my view of life. They want something that audiences will really enjoy. It's a very good corrective to a tendency in me, which was in all my early lousy novels, to just, you know, be me and perhaps preach. That's the danger, isn't it, in somebody who feels they have something to say, and nobody wants to be preached at. So the film work, from the beginning to this very day, keeps me in check, keeps me aware that there's an audience out there that I have to consider. On the other hand, my book work does something psychologically very necessary for me. I think I'd go insane if I was just a screenwriter. You talk to any screenwriter and you'll find it's very, very tough. the way that you can be dumped at any time, rewritten at any time. Your work is not regarded as your own work, and I mean that absolutely legally. When I write a movie, it belongs to the studio. It doesn't belong to me. They can do what they like with it. So I have to have somewhere to go, A, to do the, I think, deeper stuff in me, and B, to do the stuff that is just me. Now, when I write a book, nobody pays me for that. I write it, and then I send it in, and I hope somebody will publish it, and then they pay me something. Not a great deal, but something. So it's mine, and I take the risk. With the films, it's the entirely the other way around. They pay me, and I start writing. And I think there's something kind of valuable about having that back and forth between the two. It's not something I ever planned, but I'm very, very grateful to both. I would not be able to live as comfortably as I do if I didn't write the films, but I would be insane if I didn't write the novels.
William Nicholson. His novel is called Amherst, and for our listeners in the Amherst, Massachusetts area, Nicholson will be speaking at the Amherst Women's Club, the setting for Nick's house in his novel, on March 8th. Then, on March 11th, he'll give a talk and signing at the Harvard Bookshop in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Go to writersvoice.net for more information about those events. Next up, we talk about 19th-century preacher and reformer Henry Ward Beecher. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. In 2007, we talked with historian Debbie Applegate about another 19th century figure connected to Amherst's history, Henry Ward Beecher. In his time, Beecher was the most famous man in America. That's also the title of Applegate's biography of Beecher. Now, he's probably more famous as the brother of Harriet Beecher Stowe, author of one of the most popular books of all time, Uncle Tom's Cabin. But Henry has a fascinating story of his own. Here's a long excerpt from my interview with Applegate in 2007. I was joined on the conversation by then Writer's Voice associate producer Michael Pollitt, who's gone on to his own project since. In today's America, evangelical Christianity is associated with a right-wing brand of conservative politics that the topic of our show today, 19th century evangelical preacher Henry Ward Beecher, would find surprising, if not repellent. He preached a gospel of love, not retribution, was a passionate opponent of slavery, and advocated a natural marriage of reason and feeling that America has seemed to forget is possible. Along with his equally famous sister, Harriet Beecher Stowe, he was part of an abolition movement that freed the slaves and helped create a new progressive political party, the Republican Party. Our guest, Debbie Applegate, started studying Henry Beecher as an 18-year-old undergraduate at Amherst College. She went on to write her doctoral thesis about him and then spent another 7 years writing her acclaimed biography, The Most Famous Man in America. Debbie Applegate, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Ah, thank you so much for having me.
And I'm joined here also by my co-host, Michael Pollitt.
Hello.
All right, well, Michael, why don't you start out?
All right. Debbie Applegate, why the title, The Most Famous Man in America?
Because, in fact, Henry Ward Beecher was, for 30 years, the most famous man in America. We could say maybe Abraham Lincoln was more famous, but really only for about 5 or 6 years, and then he was a martyr, and then it's a whole different kind of fame once you're a saint, isn't it? But Henry Ward Beecher was kind of a combination of Billy Graham, Bill Clinton, and Paris Hilton all rolled up into one. He was famous for religion, for politics, for being a cultural gadfly in a million different ways, and also for a big scandal. But now, he's probably best remembered as the brother of Harriet Beecher Stowe.
How did it come to be that a brother and a sister were probably the two most famous people in America in their time.
Well, you know, it turns out there were lots of Beechers. It turns out the Beechers, the Beecher clan, was as important as any of the big 19th century clans, like the James family, the Adams family, even, say, the Kennedys. They were as influential or more than most. His father, Lyman Beecher, was one of the last of the great Puritan ministers in America, and he was filled with both worldly and spiritual ambition. He had 12 children, 11 of whom lived to adulthood, and almost all of them became important public figures, including his two sisters, not just Harriet, whose fame, literally, she was the Dan Brown of her day. That's how popular, that's how well-read she was. You would go anywhere on the train, in a carriage. You would, anywhere you looked, there were people reading Uncle Tom's Cabin. It made, I don't know, what's the Harry Potter phenomenon, perhaps, is almost the best way to think about it, because they literally had little tchotchkes and little, you know, picture, everything. You could buy merchandise to go along with it. Really huge. But it wasn't just Harriet. His other sister, Catherine Beecher, was pretty much the Martha Stewart of her day. She basically invented home economics, was a famous writer and activist in many different fields. And his brothers, who all went on to national prominence as theologians or as preachers, all seven of the Beecher boys went into the ministry, whether they wanted to or not, pushed by their father. So it's one of those moments where you had a charismatic, powerful father who somehow pushed all of his kids to greatness, but also to great depths in some ways.
Tell us a little bit about Lyman Beecher, Henry's father. He began to mold Henry, and then Henry took off. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about Henry through his dad, Lyman.
Well, it's true, and I probably shouldn't use this high psychiatric language, but you could say it is a perfect Oedipal story. Lyman Beecher, one of the great characters in American history, he was very dogmatic in his pulpit life. He was one of the founders of what we would now call the religious right, bringing government and religion together in the time after they finally got rid of state-sponsored religion. In many ways, publicly, kind of a bigot, kind of a stiff guy, but in his private life, could not have been a more loving father, a more devoted and lovable family man. And I think it's that split between a very flexible and emotionally open personal life and a very dogmatic and powerful public life that really inspired Henry. He couldn't really rebel from his father. So all he wanted was his father's approval, and yet he couldn't really follow his path easily, even though he was forced into it. So really what happens is not that he explicitly rebels, he just takes everything and remolds it. So his father preaches God as a sort of a capricious judge, religion as a rule of law, and Jesus as almost more of a scapegoat than anything more personal, and religion as really about saving your soul from the fires of hell. Henry, he has no taste for that. He is a blithe, boisterous boy. He wants nothing to do with this Yankee Calvinism. So when he enters the ministry, he remakes it so that God is not a judge, but a loving parent, so that religion is here to make you happy on earth, not just save you from the fires of hell. And Christ, this is probably his greatest contribution. Christ really wasn't a big part of American Christianity before this. He really brings Jesus into the picture and puts him front and center and says, Jesus is not just some legal scapegoat to make up for our sins, but he is your friend, your pal, your brother, who will carry you through life and make you happier. A revolution.
He talked about the gospel of love. And it's interesting, as you're talking, it sounds as if he brings a much more personal kind of a religion here, the kind of personal religion that we've become very familiar with today, and yet there are some vast differences in terms of the way he and those who believed in him
turned their use of religion and the way they saw the world.
Well, it's interesting because Henry sometimes is called a sentimentalist, much like Harriet, his sister, Uncle Tom's Cabin, and Henry's preaching, and he was a first-class preacher. That is really the best source of his fame. And so you got to remember, this is before TV, before good Christian people would go to the theater. I mean, going to see preaching and going to see his public lectures was one of the first kind of mass entertainment for respectable people. So he really combined a lot of things that we think of as separate. He really combined that feeling of the heart, that what religion is about is how you feel towards God and how you feel towards others, which really was not the way you talked about it before. You would talk about, you know, sin. Am I a good guy? Am I good or am I bad? He really was all for getting rid of the good-bad distinctions. But also, he was not just a heart religion fellow. He was an activist. He really said there is no good religion that is not actively working towards the human good as well as the glory of God. And that leads directly to the politics that he promotes. But also, he was a real intellectual. He was part of the first wave of people in America in the 1830s, to adopt science as kind of their own new religion in a funny way. He loved cause and effect. He loved the scientific method of observation. He was one of the things that I've loved so much about him is he is ecumenical. He's generous. He's liberal in the old-fashioned sense. He has no room for bigotry, no room for judgment in that harsh way. That gets him into trouble, but it also is part of his genius.
How did it get him into trouble?
Well, you know, it is the irony of writing about a long-dead white Protestant minister. You'd think it would be as uncontroversial as possible. But in fact, the book is all about the three things you should never talk about in polite conversation. First, the religion, then the politics, his anti-slavery politics, but then there's sex. At the peak of his career, after the Civil War, he's a hero in the North. He is making money hand over fist. He even writes a best-selling novel. And at the exact peak of his career, he is accused of seducing his best friend's wife and one of his most pious parishioners. We all know how that kind of thing can go.
It wasn't also possibly the first relationship that he had out of wedlock.
Well, you know, when I first took him on as a project, I thought, I fell in love with him in the way a lot of people did back in his lifetime. He's charismatic. He's progressive. He's got a humor and a charm. But then as I was going along, I thought, oh, my golly, he's had this really big sex scandal. He gets accused. There's a cover-up because, of course, there's always a cover-up. And, of course, the cover-up crumbles. In 1872, the scandal breaks. And it turns out, well, it's not just this woman. There are perhaps other women who have been, one might say, seduced. But in the end, there's scandal, there's a trial when the cuckolded husband sues him for what he called criminal conversation. The trial lasts 6 months. I mean, this is a scandal that makes, say, the O.J. Simpson trial or the Michael Jackson trial look like small potatoes. It's where really the paparazzi were invented. But in the end, even after 6 months of testimony, the jury can't decide. This lovable man? How could he be so guilty? It's a hung jury, 9 in favor of his guilt, 3 in favor of his innocence. So I figured, oh, I will, you know, I'll get the smoking gun. I'll find out for sure if it's true. Well, I was never 100% able to prove the big scandal, which we've heard about, but in digging, I dug up at least what I think are 2 other affairs and what is probably what they used to call a love child, an illegitimate child with another one of his parishioners and his another best friend's wife.
You're listening to Writer's Voice. We're talking with Debbie Applegate about her book, The Most Famous Man in America. But maybe we ought to step back a little bit now.
stay away from the sordid part.
Well, we'd love to get back to it. But tell us a little bit more. He's larger than life. Give us a picture. Give us a sense. What did he look like? What would it be like to be in the same room as him?
That's a really great question. No one's ever really put it to me like that. Well, for one thing, let me just say he was a bundle of contradictions, which is wonderful when you're writing about someone, but also can be very frustrating. He was not a handsome man. He actually had much of the sort of, you might say, the Mick Jagger complex, a lot plumper than Mick Jagger, a round-faced fellow who got a little plumper as time went on, especially during the scandal. But he was not a conventionally handsome man, as Mark Twain once put it. He can really, when he's in the full tide of animation, he's an awfully handsome man when he's sermonizing, but he is homely as a singed cat when he's not doing anything. But it didn't matter. He had that kind of personality. Even his, you know, sisters and brothers say he was born with that bubbly effervescence, that kind of take life easy, always feeling generous, always ready to be friendly. Not that he didn't have his dark sides, but it was that blithe, cheerful quality that just shone through in everything he did. Curious, lively, friendly, without a bone of snobbery in him. Although, it is true, he started off a poor preacher's kid, ended up very wealthy, and by the time he was done, he had many habits. He liked to carry unset jewels in his pocket so that he could take them out, you know, when he was feeling down and look at them. Well, you know, who would feel down with a pocket full of unset jewels? He was full of schemes, but not like a reformer, but more like someone who was an enthusiast. He really is the Forrest Gump of the 19th century. It's honestly true. Or Zelig, if you're a little on the older side.
He was always in the right place at the right time.
That's right. And that's how I ended up, I think, getting drawn into this project. Every time I would turn around, there's Susan B. Anthony coming by. There's General Grant. There's, you know, Emerson. I mean, there's a great story at one point where Emerson goes to see Henry preach. His church, he had one of the very first mega churches in Brooklyn Heights, still stands. Brooklyn Heights looks almost exactly as it did when he was there. And Emerson's come to see him because his daughter doesn't really care for Emerson's writings, but loves Henry. And while he's there, General Grant is there. And then there's a great story. Emerson's as starstruck by seeing General Grant, or President Grant, as anyone. I mean, you don't really get to see those private sides. And that's one of the great things about his story. Whatever hot topic is going on, whether it's the Civil War or whether women should wear bloomers, there he is.
You mentioned his church, the Plymouth Church. Is that it? Tell us about that. I think that gives a little bit of insight into his character.
He was one of the, he literally had a mega church in the way that we think of them now. 3,000 people every Sunday, and a real, in many ways, some people criticized it as a cult of personality. He didn't have a lot of time of day for other kinds of ecclesiastical duties or ties. He liked to be free, and he preached a very free gospel of love, often contradicting himself. But it didn't really matter if he was always logical or coherent because he was a firecracker on stage. And in fact, his church, very unusually, is built like a stage with kind of a platform that comes out. He didn't want a pulpit to get in between him and the rest of the crowd. He was, frankly, would have been an actor, I think, if he were born today. He had all of the great traits of that. In his own mind, I think he thought he should have been a politician.
There's a really wonderful story that you tell in the book of something that happens in the Plymouth Church when he brings in a young girl, a young slave girl, and he fires up the crowd to rescue her. Why don't you tell us that story?
Well, it really, I think, captures the essence of Beecher in a million different ways. You know, it's hard to picture nowadays what it was like to be on the eve of the Civil War. Just that kind of hatred, that kind of tension, the idea that the country was in danger of bursting apart. And what Henry did, he had nothing really to offer as a political solution. I had a lot of political advice, but he was not a senator. He was not going to solve the actual slavery problem, but like his sister Harriet, what he said was, I can change the way people feel. Which is really what Uncle Tom's Cabin did, and that's what his speeches, his preaching, and his writing did. Realizing that changing the way people feel is the first step to changing laws and changing policies. So he would do things, instead of writing treatises, he would have stunts, very emotional stunts. And one of his most famous is he brought up a couple times young, beautiful, light-skinned slave girls from the South who were going to be sold at auction. going downriver, but instead he would bring them into the church, bring them up on that big platform, and pretend to be an auctioneer, mimicking an auctioneer auctioning this young girl to slavery, or in this case, to freedom, literally whipping up the congregation until they are throwing money into the collection baskets, they're taking off their jewelry to pay for their freedom, and literally sobbing, hysterical, happens a couple times. I mean, and of course people are outraged. You're in the church, and not only that, selling someone, because literally they were buying her freedom. And yet, at a time when people really didn't care that much about slavery in the North, there are a lot of people who, you know, if it weren't for the Civil War, they would have been fine to leave the slaves where they were. It changed a lot of people's minds to be asked to imagine if this is your daughter. What if this were your daughter up here about to be sold into a life of beating and rape and labor? Huge impact. Same thing with he sends rifles. Boxes of rifles and Bibles out to the settlers out in Kansas who are fighting the pro-slavery forces. They're the anti-slavery camp settlers. Many people think of them as terrorists. So imagine the country's most prominent minister sending the equivalent of AK-47s, high-repeating, high-tech rifles to, you know, terrorists. It really quite something. It's hard to picture even now.
And we're talking with Debbie Applegate about The Most Famous Man in America, her biography of Henry Ward Beecher.
And yet, Debbie Applegate, he many times had one foot in the abolition movement and one foot still outside of that circle. He had a hard time putting his whole self behind the freeing of the slaves and the changing of the laws. And
Nobody really has asked me that question, and yet it's so central to who he is. I mean, that's one of the contradictions that absolutely drove me insane, because sometimes he would be very bold, and then other times he would step back very quickly, and especially on politics, but it was true in his personal life, it was true in his preaching, and I think it's because of the nature of being such a brilliant speaker and a bit of a hothead. He would get so worked up in the moment with the audience, and he never worked from notes, he always spoke off the top of his head with a basic outline, that he would end up saying things that often he believed in the moment, but couldn't really totally justify, you know, when the Fuhrer had burned down a little bit. And I think he often wanted things to be better than he could see them. They could see the path to get there. He could see the end of slavery, but he oftentimes wanted to shy away from the things that might go along with it, like the idea of a slave rebellion. Oh, well, that's not, you know, that's no good. Well, why not? He couldn't quite say. He just didn't sound like a good idea.
Even though he could send rifles to the Kansas, to the whites there.
Exactly.
But on the other hand, too, you said before he was like the Bill Clinton of his time. And it seems to me, you know, most of all, he wanted to be loved.
That's right.
And so that's a very hard position to be in. That's a very hard place to take positions from.
Well, you know, it's funny. Despite the fact that I felt like this book was going to be, and I structured it very much, a little like a psychological thriller, and very much around that kind of psychological question. What happens when you are dying for love and it leads you to greatness, but it also leads you to the brink, or sometimes over the brink, of excess? And in particular, on all kinds of scores, but especially on the adultery question. Well, in the end, I mean, I took 7 years to write this book. I wrote about it for my dissertation before that and my senior thesis before that. You would think that after all that, I would absolutely have an opinion about why someone would be a chronic adulterer. And in the end, as I was writing the very last page, at the very end of my deadline, I realized in the end, it was as much a mystery to me why he would consider throwing away his career for a sexual peccadillo as it was when I started.
And why?
Well, in the end, my editor says, well, you can't just throw up your hands and not say, you know, you have to say something. So I really, really pushed and thought about it. And here's what I finally came to, is I think there are two different kinds of great people, or let's say great men in particular. I haven't made as much of a study of great women, so I suspect they're different. There are some great men, say like William Lloyd Garrison, another abolitionist, or maybe a Ralph Nader would be a good modern example, who are, I feel, driven like a bayonet from the back by their principles. They are so outraged, they are so angry that they have to do something, even if they would not necessarily be inclined to do something. And they thus are find themselves on the path to greatness. Then there are the others, and Beecher certainly is one of them, and I don't mean to make an invidious comparison, but I think Bill Clinton might be one of them. Those people, they're not driven from the back, they are drawn to the light. They want the approval, they want the love, the attention that comes from accomplishment, and that leads them on the path to greatness. The problem is those people are more lovable than, say, the Ralph Naders of the world, but that also gets you into trouble because you start getting treated like a rock star, and you want all that love. It's very easy to forget that the rules apply to you the same way.
Right. There's something I just have to ask you about, mostly because of where we are. And that is, I had never known that he had a very special connection to Amherst. He went to high school here, basically, and he went to college. He went to Amherst College. Tell us a little bit about what Amherst College was like. I mean, at that time, it was really in the vanguard.
That is certainly true. On the other hand, it was also considered a priest factory. As some people said, it was founded to turn out congregational ministers to fight what they called the Unitarian menace spreading from Boston. So his father sent him to Amherst because it was a tiny little newfound college. He thought he would be safer here than at Yale, where they, you know, much more rowdy. But in many ways, it actually wasn't that different. It is true Amherst does not turn out as many ministers as it used to, but they both, now and then, have a very brainy, bookish quality. Henry loved college and lived it up. He did not get very good grades. He spent a lot of time socializing, reading what he wanted. But it had that intense atmosphere of a bunch of people who came here because what they liked is ideas and books. He discovers the Romantic movement coming from Europe, which hugely influences him. The idea of being, more about feeling than thought, the idea of being anti-tradition, all the have a huge influence on him, but also he discovers science here, and that really shapes his thinking. He becomes a real rational thinker as well as an emotional thinker. It's also important to point out that Amherst, if you're from here, you won't find this too surprising. A lot of small towns, these little Yankee small towns back then, maybe even now, were very closed-minded, very closed little places. Amherst was really saved from that by its passion for higher education that continues now. There are still colleges everywhere and universities everywhere you look, including where we are right now. One of the fun things about the book is it's really a geographical journey, starting in Connecticut and Massachusetts and going to Ohio and Indiana, and then into New York, where, of course, he bursts into fame. And one of the really fun things is in the East, Brooklyn Heights, Litchfield, Connecticut, the north end of Boston, and Amherst all look very, very similar to when he was there. You can really walk around, and if you squint, you can really see what it was like.
And that was Debbie Applegate talking in 2007 with me and with Writer's Voice Associate Producer Michael Pollitt. You can hear the entire interview by going to writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Then check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.